Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Have you ever wondered how a country can run out of money? Well, we might be about to find out because Greece is back in the news. There is oil to talk about as well. And we'll wrap things up with our series, I've Always Wondered. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, the 11th day of May. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. One hesitates to say, yet again, that Greece has taken a step back from the brink, but say it today, one must. This afternoon, Athens made, as required, a 757 million euro debt repayment. That's about $848 million, give or take. Payment was made, of course, to its international creditors, but Marketplace's Tim Fitzsimmons reports the country's finances may have backed its left-leaning government far back into a political corner.
It's something of a miracle that Greece's anti-austerity government was able to come up with the funds without trampling all over its anti-austerity pledges. Athens got it by demanding local governments hand over their cash reserves. But it will only buy Greece a moment of relief given the country's battered finances.
This is absolutely the tightest it's been.
Douglas Elliott is a fellow at the Brookings Institution. He says after this, the Greek government has almost no liquidity. It can finance itself until the end of May, maybe June, and it still has to repay billions to its EU creditors.
Those are the people they really have to work out a deal with.
So can Greece and the EU work out a new deal in time? Germany's finance minister said he wouldn't oppose a Greek referendum on any deal. The implication is that if Greeks reject it, the country could be forced to exit the eurozone. John Tsaropoulos, a blogger in Athens, says a Greek exit is a nuclear option that gets thrown around by critics of Greece and also by the country's left-wing government.
What it is entitled to do is to negotiate a continued presence of Greece within the eurozone. It is not authorized to negotiate an exit, even a controlled one.
Greece's government has talked tough with its creditors, but it has improved the country's finances. Vicky Price is chief economic advisor at the Center for Economic and Business Research. She says the government has enraged many of its supporters, but also lowered the country's debt.
In other words, improved its fiscal position a lot more than many other countries have done.
So the EU may be moved by Greece's efforts or frustrated enough to take a tougher line. In Washington, I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
The Wall Street Journal got its hands on a draft strategy report from OPEC today, the contents of which are interesting indeed. The cartel is forecasting crude prices under $100 a barrel for perhaps as long as a decade, maybe as low as $76 a barrel in its most optimistic scenarios. Here with, however, Marketplace's Annie Baxter with the caveats.
Let's start with one of the basic issues at stake in OPEC's forecast. The time frame is kind of nuts. So says Pavel Molchanov, an energy analyst with Raymond James.
It is always a fool's errand to be making predictions for oil prices or, frankly, just about anything else 10 years ahead.
That said, Molchanov agrees we're probably not going to see oil trading at $100 a barrel again anytime soon. And that can help net importers of oil, like the U.S. He says this past year, cheaper oil has meant a roughly dollar a gallon decline in gas prices.
That translates into, you know, for a typical household, somewhere in the $600 to $800 a year benefit.
But that benefit has been muted in the economy so far.
Yeah, we had assumed the money would be treated as a windfall, and consumers did better than that.
Doug Handler is chief U.S. economist at IHS Global Insight. He says consumers have mostly saved their money or paid down debt. That may help them, but consumer spending doesn't get juiced. Handler says cheaper oil's benefits could show up more meaningfully in lower inflation.
And the lower inflation, of course, improves buying power of consumers.
But complicating this picture is the volatility of oil prices. Bob McNally is president of the Rapidan Group.
The average may well be 70, but the range could be 20 to 150.
McNally says whether you're a producer or consumer of oil, it's just hard to plan around that kind of seesawing. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Before we get off oil for just a second, this item. This afternoon, the White House gave conditional approval to Shell Oil to start drilling up in the Arctic Ocean. Protests and lawsuits certainly to follow on that one. On Wall Street today, down went the three major indices. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We get more books about leadership strategies here than you can shake a stick at. Not that often, though, which is to say, never. Do you get one by the guy who used to run the Pentagon's Special Operations Forces in Iraq and Afghanistan? Stan McChrystal, General, United States Army, retired by name. His new book is called Team of Teams, New Rules of Engagement for a Complex World. It's good to have you with us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
This is not a memoir. You wrote that a couple of years ago about your service in the military and then overseas in Afghanistan and Iraq. It is, though, I would say, sort of autobiographical.
Well, because it was based on the core experience that caused me to transform how I think about leadership.
Explain that a little bit.
Well, I grew up in a conventional force. The United States Army is about as conventional as you can get. And in the fall of 2003, when I took command of an organization, a Joint Special Operations Task Force, we were extraordinarily effective, and we were specially selected and lavishly resourced and very well trained. But what we found was we were losing the war in Iraq. So the challenge that we faced was we could either continue to be very, very good at what we did and fail, or we could change ourselves fundamentally to be successful. And we chose the latter, obviously. And much of this book is about the road to do that.
Okay, but here's the thing. Special forces units, as you talked about and as you said just now, are lavishly resourced, extraordinarily well trained. They have incredibly tight and high unit cohesion. That does not exist in a lot of businesses and in much of corporate America today, right? You've got people making $9 an hour, $7 an hour, in jobs they don't necessarily like, and yet their competitive environment changes almost faster than they can process. So what are you supposed to do there?
Well, Kai, that's one of the key points. In fact, in the organizations that I was in, which were so elite, sometimes the aversion to change or resistance is even higher. Their very identity is wrapped up into how things had been done. But there still needs to be this creation of the idea of shared consciousness that we all understand what we're trying to do against a common understanding of what the problem is so we can react quickly.
On the topic of actually making sure everybody understands what you're trying to do, you say, I think this is a verbatim quote in this book, you say, share information until it's almost illegal.
The old idea that we will only share information with someone who needs to know, that's sort of the tagline from movies and whatnot, is basically flawed because who knows who needs to know? Time and again, there will be a piece of information you don't share and you don't realize how critical it is to someone else.
You talking about speed and agility and change in economic America today makes me think of nothing more than Silicon Valley. And I wonder how you feel about technology and the leadership. And, you know, are generals of the future going to be more Mark Zuckerberg-like than Stan McChrystal-like?
I think it's a great question. What we see in Silicon Valley right now is a tremendous amount of innovation. But the idea that big data is suddenly going to give us the answer to the problem is something that in the book we find to be incorrect because the speed at which data is being created and changed stays ahead of our ability to harness it. I really believe it's going to be someone who creates an ecosystem. In that ecosystem, the leader allows a whole host of leaders inside that to interact and be effective, and that's where the power comes from.
You are obviously a guy, based on your writings and our talk so far, who believes in letting subordinates do their jobs and act independently without that leader having direct or controlling oversight. Having you on the line, I have to ask you then how that plays into the Rolling Stone article that led to your undoing and your eventual retirement and later career.
Sure, Kai, that's fair. To begin with, I believe in winning. if centralized decision-making was the best way to go, that's what I'd do. In the case of trusting your staff, I trusted my team in a case that when sometimes things come out wrong, and they don't always come out right, and the most important thing is to learn from it quickly, learn from it immediately, keep the confidence of the organization up, move forward. And that's what I think is really important.
It's a book called Team of Teams by Stan McChrystal, General, United States Army retired. General, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Kai, thank you.
We talked about a bunch of things Stan McChrystal and I did that we didn't have time to fit on the air, including his thoughts about national service in this country and the civilian-military disconnect in this society. We've got it all posted on our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up.
You can't open them. You got to use your teeth, and then you squeeze it out. You never get enough, and it gets all over your hands.
I'm just going to let you guess what that story is about. But here's a hint. It's from our series, I've Always Wondered. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off about 85 points on this Monday. That's a 0.5% or so. Closed at 18,105, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ down 9 points, 0.2%. Ended things at 49.93. The S&P 500 off 10 points, 0.5%. Finished at 21.05. Falling oil prices hit energy companies today. Murphy Oil slid 3.33%. National Oil Well Varco slid 3.5%. Tesoro was down 2.5% today. Monster Beverage fizzed up 4.3% after a Citigroup analyst upgraded the energy drink maker. Dish Network beamed down 0.7%, however. The satellite TV provider announced quarterly results today that showed its profits doubled, but it lost a whole bunch of subscribers. Hate it when that happens. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases its job openings and labor turnover survey for March. Time to get saucy. May is National Barbecue Month. And musician Billy Squier turns 65. Remember, everybody wants you at their barbecue. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Ladies and gentlemen, I am so pleased to be able to tell you that our long national nightmare is over. American Idol will soon be no more. Fox made the announcement this morning at the start of what are known as the upfronts, a week or so of big show business to-dos in Manhattan, where TV ad time for the coming year is sold off. Used to be that about 3/4 of all ads for the upcoming TV season were booked during the upfronts, that is, before the season even aired. But Marketplace's Adam Allington reports that, as with many things media these days, that is no longer the case.
This is a classic commercials are dead, long live commercials type story. John Steinlauf is the president of ad sales for Scripps Networks, which produces shows like House Hunters and Chopped. He says access to more and more consumer data means advertisers are more strategic with their investments.
Is it better to make decisions early and gain the cost savings that come along with it? Or are we better off holding our money and deciding closer and closer to air what decisions we want to make?
Today's ad buyers want the broad reach of TV with the flexibility of the internet. Steinlauf says the upfront still accounts for half of all Scripps ad sales. And while TV viewership has been dropping for years now, the market for content is actually bigger than ever.
We have to bear in mind that the definitions are very, very much changing in the TV landscape.
Tim Nolan is a media analyst for Macquarie Securities. Even though the upfront may be shrinking, the news is not all bad for networks. Thanks to the growth of things like mobile apps and DVRs, the platforms to sell ads is also increasing.
And how often do you see people sitting on a train, you know, watching a show on their phone, which was impossible to do even a few years ago. So it's just about everybody trying to grab pieces of that larger pie now.
Nolan says Nielsen ratings are still the metric used for assigning a dollar value to TV ads. However, the company's also looking at new ways to track eyeballs on things like digital ads for mobile apps. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Annie Baxter was telling us about oil a little bit earlier, how OPEC figures it's going to be relatively cheap for a relatively long period of time. The thing about oil is, though, that you just don't know. They call them oil booms for a reason, right? That roller coaster cycle of prices going up and down and then down and up for reasons not always apparent. Marketplace's Stan Alcorn went out to the oil fields of Carlsbad, New Mexico, to see what that ride feels like when you're in the middle of it.
Jake Marbach has a map of the county tacked to the wall of his cramped office.
White City, where you went through.
And as far as, like, where there's active oil production, is it kind of...
Everywhere.
It's everywhere.
Yeah. Everywhere in the east two-thirds of the county.
There's always been oil in Eddy County, but in the last few years, fracking has opened up new deposits with names like Bone Spring and Wolf Camp. And oil companies have been hiring firms like Marbach's to find and buy rights to drill for these deposits. It's a business that, like so much in the county's economy, is booming as long as the price of oil is high. Though when it was $100 a barrel last year, Marbach didn't really follow the oil price.
I'd look at it and admire it about once a week, and just happy it was where it was at. But as far as actually tracking it, no, we were so busy and the companies kept ordering work, I didn't pay any attention to it till it really started going down.
He watched it through the fall as it dropped to $90, $80, $70 a barrel.
When it went below 50, that's when they started kind of pulling the plug on a lot of these projects.
That was in January. His oil company customers all at once cut him off, and he had to fire half his staff.
I had one young guy that moved here from Fort Worth just specifically to work for me, and I had to lay him off, and that was rough.
Now his business is just starting to come back. The records room of the county clerk's office is where a lot of that work happens. It's a room with six long, narrow tables that double as bookshelves for hundreds of oversized hardbacks full of deeds and mortgages going back to the 1800s. When oil was $100, these tables were packed shoulder to shoulder with dozens of landmen, as they're called. But now there are just four, one of whom is Wesley Burnett, the guy Marbach fired.
Did you see it kind of coming? Or?
I mean, everyone kind of knew for a couple weeks, you know. It was like, when is it going to happen?
He spent a few unemployed weeks doing odd jobs and watching TV at home, but now he's back doing research for oil companies. For now.
That's also a risk like everyone in this courthouse is taking, doing this kind of work. They kind of know that it can end at the drop of a pin, you know.
But it's not just the people in this room who feel the impact of these ups and downs. In fact, oil has kind of remade the city. The roads here are full of trucks. 18-wheelers hauling water and heavy equipment, and pickups with oil company logos on the side or in the rear windshield. These trucks fill the parking lots of restaurants like McAllister's and Happy's and of the newest, tallest buildings in town, hotels. At least six have opened since the oil boom started. David Burton is the general manager of the Comfort Suites.
I would say that a good 75% of our guests are tied to the oil and gas industry in some way, shape, or form.
Men wearing oil company polo shirts and driving oil company trucks, often paying with oil company credit cards. But they cut some of that spending this winter.
Our rates have come down probably close to $100 a night. They were about $350, and they've come down to about $250.
That sounds like a lot.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, we definitely noticed it.
The hotel lowered its prices week by week. But for permanent housing, it takes a lot longer for supply to meet demand.
We were short on housing before the oil boom started.
Jeff Campbell at the Carlsbad Department of Development says the housing shortage here got worse over the last 5 years as the oil boom nearly doubled the population from under 30,000 to more than 50,000 people.
Right now when the oil play is down a little bit, it gives us a little bit of a chance to catch up.
Contractors from Fernando Corona's Plastering are spreading cement onto the last few two-story buildings of Copperstone Apartments. Cesar Enriquez is rinsing the cement off his tools. He says the oil price drop hasn't affected his work.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of work right here, bro. There's a lot of work right here and in Hobbs, too.
Hobbs is another town in New Mexican oil country where you can be sure a lot of people are hoping the oil price rebound continues. In Carlsbad, New Mexico, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace. We'll be right back.
We've got a series we run every other Monday about some of the peculiarities of the global economy that you, the listening public, have been curious about. It's called I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blade work.
With that, we now turn to the number one selling product offered by the H.J. Heinz Company out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which, assuming its merger plans go through, will soon become part of the Kraft Heinz Company. It is ketchup, yes, no prizes for guessing that. But I'm talking here specifically about those little 9-gram ketchup packets that you get at fast food places. Heinz says it sells about 11 billion of them a year. Our question today came from listener Callie Denhire via Marketplace's Dan Weissman. Here you go.
Callie asked,
I've always wondered how they decided to make ketchup packets the size that they are.
And I thought I knew why she asked.
One is never enough.
Right, exactly.
And let's be honest, that's just one problem. Here's Rich Cohen. He's a writer.
You can't open them. You got to use your teeth, and then you squeeze it out. You never get enough, and it gets all over your hands.
In other words, there's a bigger question here. Why are ketchup packets so awful? And Rich Cohen thinks his grandpa Ben played a role. Ben Eisenstadt ran a diner across from the Brooklyn Naval Yard in the 30s and 40s. It boomed during World War II, then went bust when all the sailors went home. Time for a new business.
And he had this idea that he should package tea.
Ben had worked in a tea packing plant as a kid, knew how the machines worked. He bought a machine to make tea bags, installed it in the empty diner, and quickly found that this had been a terrible idea. Too much competition.
So he didn't know what to do. He's sort of out of money, completely out of ideas, and goes out to a meal at Cookies in Brooklyn with my grandma, Betty. And he's like, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And she said, why don't you package sugar?
She had worked with Ben in the diner, cleaned up the bowls that people had dipped spoons into. Gross. Ben reconfigured the teabag machine to make sugar packets. It was the first modern food service packet. Later, he packaged other things, duck sauce, soy sauce. Rich's theory?
The platonic form of all the packets is that original teabagging machine turned into a sugar machine in the Cumberland Diner.
People who have worked in the food service packet engineering world for decades said, this is as good a theory as any. They confirm Ben Eisenstadt invented the sugar packet, and that was the first one. The size could be a remnant. Descendants of Grandpa Ben's teabag machine now churn out more than 8,000 ketchup packets a minute in the Red Gold factory near Indianapolis. Red Gold has packed tomatoes since 1942. Later, the company expanded into ketchup. Dave Halt came in 17 years ago to help crack the food service market. He asked customers what they wanted.
It became very clear that they wanted to buy their ketchup packets in a particular size. Still haven't quite figured out how they, you know, decided that 9-gram was the exact size that was needed.
Did you ask? Like, so why 9 grams?
Well, we did. And it was the typical answer. Well, that's the size we've always bought. And that's the size that they've always come in.
Red Gold offers 7-gram packets and 11-gram packets, but there is very little demand. Also, there's this.
The actual cost of the package is really more than the 9 grams of ketchup that's inside.
Keeping moisture and oxygen from getting in, keeping highly acidic ketchup from eating its way out, not easy, not cheap. And it's not that nobody has tried to design a better ketchup packet.
There was a time where McDonald's was hiring every design firm under the sun.
That's Jeremy Alexis. He worked for one of those design firms. This is about a dozen years ago. McDonald's wanted innovation, improvements. So, the way designers do, Jeremy and the others spent a lot of time observing exactly how people used McDonald's products. That meant riding around with moms on the go, getting drive-through, and talking on the phone.
At the same time, the kids would be yelling, I want the food now, I need it now, so they'd be handing the food back all at the same time.
Ketchup everywhere.
The designer would say, I've got it! This is the moment! I've been waiting for this! This is the aha moment! I'm going to go and redesign ketchup packets.
Jeremy and his colleagues brought a lot of new ketchup packet designs to McDonald's leadership. He says it was like lambs being led to the slaughter. Every time,
the executive said, no, we're not going to do your new ketchup packet.
Because the new packet would cost more. McDonald's gives ketchup packets away. Each one might cost a nickel, and this is a nickel and dime business. Then, in 2010, after years of effort, Heinz actually did introduce a new ketchup packet. the Dip and Squeeze. Three times as big. Cool design. Won a Package of the Year award. Wall Street Journal headline, Old Ketchup Packet Heads for Trash. Nope. Dip and Squeeze costs more than three times as much. Operators worry teenage clerks would still pass them out by the handful. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, the website NJ.com broke the news this weekend that at least some of those ceremonies honoring the troops you've seen at NFL games the past couple of years have been paid advertisements. To cite just one example, the New York Jets got more than $377,000 from the New Jersey National Guard over 4 years for its hometown hero segments. And yes, this was an organized Pentagon ad campaign. I get that. Maybe it's just me. And full disclosure, I'm a veteran here, but one would sort of have hoped the NFL would do it just because, right? All right, that's all we got. The Dow off 85 points this Monday, about a half percent. The NASDAQ down 9 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 off 10 points. That is a half percent. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonder, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We are back again tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.